We're at Paramount Pictures in Hollywood, California, for a visit with Milt Joseph Berg, who was one of the top comedy writers ever, and he's the author of the Jack Benny Show, published by Arlington House. Milt, you first started working for Jack Benny after a relatively successful—I shouldn't even say relatively—after a successful career as a script writer for Bob Hope. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes, I never found out what happened to him since then, but I'll run into him someday.
What was your very first writing job?
Well, when I was a kid in New York, I used to send jokes to the various columnists on newspapers. Walter Winch, Mark Hellinger, they're all gone now, so are most of the newspapers. Mm-hmm. And they began to be printed, and I eventually got a job working for a press agent, became a press agent myself. And I tried to get Bob Hope's publicity account as a press agent, and I had a young man working for me named Melville Shavelson, who had just started with me. And we wrote a humorous letter on a topical subject for Mr. Hope and submitted it to his manager, a man named Jimmy Safier, who read it over and called me back and said, this is funnier than most of the monologues that mm-hmm. I received from Mr. Hope. And we wound up working for Bob. And incidentally, Milt Shavelson, in case you don't recognize the name, is the president of the Writers Guild right now.
Oh, uh-huh.
And he has written and produced many successful, written, produced, and directed many successful pictures for Hope, including The Seven Little Foys, and also for Lucy. He did Yours, Mine, and Ours, and he is the president of the Guild. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, we came out here where we were paid the munificent salary of $100 a week each. And, of course, that was slightly over 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And that was not a bad salary.
No. In those days, well, $100 each was the equivalent of maybe $1,000 a week in uh-huh. buying power today. And I was with Bob for 5 years, and then I went with Mr. Hope for a dozen years. And if you want the rest of my major credits, then I went with Lucy for 12 years, and I went with All in the Family for 5 years, and now I'm with, in my second year, with as a special consultant, executive consultant on the Mork and Mindy Show and the Laverne and Shirley Show.
Well, your career has really bridged both the best years of radio and the best years of television as
oh,
well.
Oh, yes. And, in fact, I frequently get asked about that, the days of radio as compared to television, the differences that come in, and the best example I can give is that on the Jack Benny Show, once we had a joke, and this is radio, mm-hmm. where Don Wilson came into the house to see Jack Benny about doing a commercial, and Jack was taking a bath at the time. And Don walked in, and we did the usual joke about Jack being in a bathtub with floating rubber ducks or things like that. And Don said, I wanted to talk about the commercial, Jack. And Jack said, okay, sit down. Well, this started about a three-day battle with the censors that you cannot say sit down when a man is taking a bath because the only place to sit is on the commode, the toilet, and so forth. We said, can he say sit down on the side of the tub? And the censor said no, because that calls attention that he shouldn't sit on the toilet. And finally, jokingly, we said, can we say put the seat down and sit down? And said no, we couldn't do that. Now, All in the Family, one of the constant running jokes was the flushing mm-hmm. of the toilet.
Yes.
And not only that, as a matter of fact, I feel very proud of, I don't know why I should feel so proud of it, but a very clever joke where Archie was up in the toilet and he yelled down, Edith, I need a fresh roll of toilet paper up here. And Jean Stapleton thought for a moment and she said, well, you'll find a fresh roll of paper in the cabinet to your left if you're standing, to your right if you're sitting. Now, you can't get more graphic than that. Going one step further with Lucille Ball, I once gave her a joke which she used about the changes in television during the period when she was having little Desi. I wasn't with her at the time, but on all of the, get the shows mixed up, on I Love Lucy, when she was pregnant, they were not permitted to say pregnant on the air.
Mm-hmm.
These days, they not only can use the word pregnant, but they practically show you how to get that
word. That's right.
Yeah. Bob Hope on an Academy Award said they are now doing things on the screen that I wouldn't do in bed, even if I could.
You didn't write that line
no,
for him?
No. I think Mort Lachman wrote it.
Well, did as a writer on The Benny Show, did you often have trouble with the censors?
Frequently. And it was very, very minor things. One of the mm-hmm. classic examples, and I mentioned this in my book, The Jack Benny Show, Life and Times of America's mm-hmm. Best Loved Entertainer. May as well plug it.
It's an excellent book. It deserves the plug.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. We were doing a takeoff on King Solomon's Mines. And this was a picture with Deborah Carr based on a famous story, and it was a big MGM production. And Jack was supposed to be searching for King Solomon's Mines, and Deborah Carr was the lady with him, and they ran into a tribe of cannibals led by Mel Blanc. And Jack says, wait a minute, these are cannibals, I can handle them, I will tell them a limerick. He says that always pleases them, and then he goes into gibberish. Magula Nagala Mamawa Mamama Magula Matata Magala Mase Magala Mate Halula Mamala Hawala. And they all laugh and they leave. And Deborah Carr says, what does that mean? And Jack, very embarrassed, says, oh, I couldn't say that to you. And I have paraphrased it now. And the censor came down and said, we cannot do that because all limericks are dirty. Now, we showed him that all limericks are not dirty, that the original limericks were clean. Now, incidentally, a follow-up on that was while it was on All in the Family, I don't know how, but Rob Reiner and Sally Struthers, Gloria and Mike, got into an argument over Gloria's father, Archie Bunker's, taste. And Mike says, I cannot believe that any man who has taste, whose favorite poem starts off, there was an old lady from Nantucket. Now, this is admittedly the start of one of the best-known dirty limericks. But the censor came down and started screaming, and Sally Struthers says, wait a minute, and she recited a perfectly clean limerick, there was an old lady from Nantucket who saved her money in the bucket. And that's all I remember, and I won't go into it. And I don't know whether we can say this on the air, but it is perfectly clean.
Uh-huh.
But in 1948 or 49, when we were saying a gibberish limerick in words that we invented, the censor didn't want to let us do it. Oh, one further thing. When Jack said to the censor, but it's gibberish. He says, it's still dirty. And Deborah Carr said, oh, come now. And the fellow just looked at her and gave in.
Well, she saved the day.
Yeah, but we we always had trouble with censors. I wrote a show for Lucy, and it was based on Jack Benny. I wrote it with a fellow named Ray Singer, and it was based on that Jack Benny wanted to dictate his biography, and it's strange that I should wind up writing one, but it was mainly his adventures with women, and we did five little vignettes where he said the first gal that I ever really cared for, she was a waitress, I was in the World War One. Oh, it started off actually with his mother, but each little vignette that we did, Lucy imagined herself playing the part of the lady.
Mm-hmm.
So first she was his mother, then she was the waitress he was in love with in World War one. Then she played the part of his vaudeville partner, and we did little sketches. And the thing is that he keeps dictating, and suddenly he starts another one and says, oh my goodness, he says, I didn't realize it was so late, it's 7 o'clock. And she says, oh, I'm not hungry. He says, I know, he says, but I have a date tonight. And at that point, the doorbell rings. And Jack goes to the door, and it's George Burns. And this is the very end of the show. And the audience, you know, applauds. Mm-hmm. And Lucy is amazed, you know, George Burns. And George says, Jack, I'm sorry that I figured you'd be late. So I took the liberty of driving over here with the two girls. And Jack says, well, tell them to come in. And George yells out, oh, Trixie, Ginger, come on in. And in came two of the cutest 75-year-old gals that you can imagine. Now, they weren't garishly made up. They were made up like very nice 75-year-old girls. And one of them says to Jack, I'm sorry that we're late, Jack, but we stopped off at the drugstore to pick up the pill, which is a tremendous scream. And Lucy says, the pill, and George Burns says, yes, the one that keeps us awake. Well, the censor came down and started to scream. He said that we're corrupting people, and we tried to explain to him that there were four people whose aggregate age may have been well over 300 years. The woman was 75. George and Jack were in their late 70s, and people would know they didn't need the pill and everything. And well, the censor said something like, we're corrupting them, and Lucy said, how can you corrupt someone if they know what the pill is for, they know that they don't need it. If they don't know what the pill is for, then the thing picking the one that keeps us awake would save it.
Mm-hmm.
I won that argument. It's not difficult to win an argument with a censor when you have a George Burns, a Jack Benny, and a Lucille Ball, mm-hmm. and where we point out it's the only joke that George had in the script. So, but that's a difference in censorship.
Well, it's over the years, and especially with the Jack Benny show, and I'm sure it's with so many other programs, at least the Lucy show that you worked on, and even with, to some degree, with Bob Hope, there was not any intention to come up with blue humor or blue comedy. It was all clean and really in good fun, but then these censors would kind of jump in on that.
That's
stuff,
right. Now, incidentally, there is a legend going around, and I was in at the start of this, as were all the writers on the Hope Show. Mr. Hope was once cut off the air. The legend has gone around, I can't repeat the jokes that he supposedly told on the air, but I have been interviewed many times where people says, I know, I have a friend who heard it. And I said, I will give $10,000 to any charity if you can produce anyone who heard Mr. Hope do this on the air. They said, well, this friend heard. I said, but I thought he was cut off for telling that joke. How could he have heard it? They may have been in a studio audience. I said, it was never done. And what had happened, the reason he had been cut off the air was this. We used to do previews, and we do the show on Sunday night. We do an hour-long show.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would condense that to the half hour. Well, when we would do the monologue, we would pick three or four different subjects and discard the one that didn't play. Well, this week we had picked three of them, and one of them was on golf. And it played very well, but it was the least topical. And we said, let's save this till we really need it. Now, one of the jokes in the monologue was, Bob says, I won't say I cheat much, but around my club I'm known as the genie with a light brown pencil. And it was a pretty good joke. Now what happened, we put that aside to use it. What happened then, there was a strike, ASCAP, which you know of, you know, it controls sure. all the music, got into a strike against the networks, and the networks were not allowed to play any ASCAP songs. The only songs they were allowed to play were BMI. The only good songs that BMI had were Stephen Foster's songs. So all over the air you heard I Dream of Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair and Camptown Races mm-hmm. and whatever else Stephen Foster heard. Well, the comics began making jokes, and after 1 week the networks became sensitive and said no more jokes about I dream of Jeannie with the light brown hair. Now we come a week later and we start to do the monologue because I play in a big golf tournament here, mm-hmm. and they refused to let us do that joke. And Bob got indignant and said, we did that joke. You have it on your records. We did it long before the ASCAP strike. They said, if you do it, we will cut you off the air. So there was like 20 seconds of silence. And now every time I am interviewed by anyone who remembers the incident, they said, isn't it true? After we're off the air, mm-hmm. I will tell you the jokes mm-hmm. if you... Mm-hmm. And you know that they, no sensible man would do jokes like this on the air, even today. My God, I heard Johnny Carson, I listened to him and admire him, and some of those monologues he does are very funny, but he did one joke, the hookers are going on strike, they want to be paid under time, and I don't know whether you'll cut that out or not, and... Then they had, I think it was either Phyllis Diller or Joan Rivers were talking about how unattractive she was. And she said, the other night she was getting ready for bed with her husband. And she said, I want you to know I have a headache. So he ran into the bathroom and hid the aspirin. And, you know what I mean? And they're doing good. And some of them I won't attempt yeah. to do what they've done on the air. What they do today is really unbelievable.
Was Hope cut off? Often, or was that
to my knowledge, that was the only time it was ever cut off. But the legend has spread, mm-hmm. and people keep by. Well, several years ago, a teenager asked me, said he heard it from his father and mother. Mm-hmm. Boy, it may have been 18, 19, mm-hmm. and no, Mr. Hope. They do a joke that is. Slightly, I'll give you an example of one joke we got by the censor. There was a very, very big song, I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, I Just Want to Start a Blaze in Your Heart, I don't know, but it was I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire. Mm-hmm. We did a joke that an ostrich got frightened and stuck its head in the sand and its tail got sunburned, and then it began singing, I don't want to sit, the world's on fire. That was a dirty joke. To get away from the censor, we put the actual wording of the song, I don't want to set the world on fire, and he looked in it, there's nothing dirty on that. Incidentally, in my book, I tell about they can't see it, but I don't know if you know who Jack Douglas is. He's married to Rako.
Sure.
He was one of the writers on the show. We're quite friendly.
On the Hope Show.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He did the best getting around a censor that I have ever heard of. And this was on the Gary Moore, Jimmy Durante radio show. Jimmy Durante came in and said, last night I had a date with Jane Russell. Now, Jane Russell was a Dolly Parton of her day. Mm-hmm. She was overly endowed. See. But anyway, Jimmy said, last night I had a date with Jane Russell. And then there was the thing, music cue, timpani. And Gary Moore said, the Jane Russell, music cue, timpani. And Durante said, yes, the Jane Russell, timpani. There's nothing wrong with that, but when it went on the air, it came out, I had a date with Jane Russell. Boom, boom. And every time the name Jane Russell was heard, you heard those timpanis going boom, boom. And it was hysterical there. But he got away from the censor on the thing.
We do want to talk a lot about the Jack Benny Show and your involvement in it. But let's talk about Hope for a little bit. You mentioned that Hope would do an hour show, a rehearsal.
Yes.
On Sunday, prior to his show was mostly on a Tuesday night.
It was on Tuesday night.
And this was overwritten, I suppose.
Sunday night, we had a slightly overwritten mm-hmm. show, and sometimes things went that would never have been permitted on mm-hmm. the air. Mm-hmm. A person would fluff a line and say something, and Hope would make a blue joke out of it. But on the air, never, to my knowledge.
Well, what was his reason? For doing, now he did this with an audience,
yes.
full audience, for doing a full hour show To test the material?
To test basically. The material, that's all. We would pick the strongest material, and many a times we'd have very strong jokes that would have to be saved for a subsequent broadcast. The writers would hand them in again, and again and again.
There were a lot of writers on the Hope show. When you were involved with it, which was what, from about
1938 to 1943, and then subsequently I wrote a little television from in the late 50s. But actually, there weren't that many writers, excepting during the first 13 weeks. What happened, he had like about 7 or 8 writers, and like about 5 or 6 were going to be let go, and 5 or 6 more were going to be taken on. But somehow their contracts overlapped, so for a period of 2 weeks, we had 13 writers. Incidentally, Mel Shavelson, who was my collaborator on the show, I collaborated with, I was his collaborator. Don't want it to sound too conceited. But he once came up with a wonderful joke about that, where Judy Garland, who was a guest star, or at that time she was on for the season, she began saying something about him having a lot of writers. And Bob says, oh, I don't have that many writers. And she says, oh, no. She says, I attended the football game Saturday, and when you and your writers walked in, it looked like Notre Dame coming out for the second half. And it's always been one of my favorite jokes. As a matter of fact, I can't see it on television. Up there, there's a picture of Bob and his writers right under that star.
Oh, yeah.
And the writers on that picture include me, Mel Shavelson, who, as I said, is the president of the Guild, Al Schwartz, who was with him for many, many, many years and did many shows, his younger brother, Sherwood Schwartz, who created two of the most successful shows in history of television, Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch. Seated there is a fellow named Jack Rose, who became a very, he and Mel Shavelson wrote and directed and produced many screen pictures, and Jack Rose's last had a very big hit with a fellow named Mel Frank. He wrote A Touch of Class, which Mel Frank produced and directed. Mel Frank was on the show the year earlier with Norman Panama, and they wrote and produced many great pictures. But at that time, there were only, and also Norman Sullivan, who was with Bob for like 34 years. But through the years, Bob did attract many famous writers who started with him. Larry Gelbart got his start there. A fellow named Larry Marks. I'm going to leave out some of them who are going to kill me. Jack Douglas. And Bob once talked, the writers who I mentioned, and that's there. At that time, their aggregate salary was $635 a week. And Bob was on a TV show and said, I don't think I could get that group now for $635,000 a week.
Probably.
Which
so.
He could. He could get it for that. But for
that he could do.
that he could. I mean, I think so. But they have all gone on to enormous success. And it was just a question of a group being there. Now, there are many others who fell by the wayside, who landed less of a season or not even a season.
Yes.
And there were numerous writers like that.
Did Bob Hope himself get very much involved in the writing or the editing of the material?
Bob got involved in the editing to some extent, but not as great as Jack Benny did. Bob would just go over the material and mark off the jokes that he liked, and the writers, Shavelson and I, would assemble one spot, and Schwartz and Sullivan would assemble another spot, and taking the jokes that Bob had marked off, and frequently there'd be 2 or 3 jokes that would be, you couldn't do them. They'd all be like duplicates in different ways, and Bob would have to select them. However, with Jack Benny, there was Balzer and Perrin were a team, and the late John Tackerberry and I were a team, and we'd split the show in half, and they would write half, I would write half with Tack, and then we would meet with Jack and put in anywhere all usually a full day, assembling the material, see that there were no conflicts, and blending it and taking out what Jack didn't like. I remember one time, and this is another incident that I mentioned in the book, The Jack Benny Show, I believe I do. There was one time we tried to be topical. Remember this, that you could do a joke on radio about a subject that happened the day before. You cannot do anything really topical in television except for Johnny Carson. Johnny Carson's monologue, and I listen to it all the time because it is the only topical humor left today.
Well, even, excuse me for a second, even Bob Hope, who will insert a monologue on his TV show at the last minute, but it's a couple of days old.
It's two days old. But what happened is we were doing our show, and we had a scene in it where Rochester was talking to a friend of his about Jack Benny, which we did frequently. And what happened that week is England devaluated the pound. The pound had been worth, in my figures, maybe off, like $4.88 in American money. It was devalued to $2.75. And please don't anybody write in and say the figures are such and such. But anyway, the value of the pound was nearly cut in half. Well, John Tackerberry and I were writing a spot where this friend of Rochester's was talking to him, and he says, does Mr. Benny, do you completely understand Mr. Benny, something like that? He says, no, he says, sometimes he puzzles me. Like, this week he started paying me in English pounds, which was a funny joke. Now, George and Sam, Perrin and Balzer, they wrote a spot, and they wrote, in their half of the show, they wrote a whole spot, three pages, with Don Wilson, where Don Wilson claimed that he no longer weighed 260 pounds, he only weighed 140 pounds. And it was very funny. But Jack read the show over, the completed show, and he said, I would rather do the one joke where Roger says, this week, for some reason, he started paying me in English pounds. Now, there is a rivalry between, among writers, particularly in those days, but when it comes to sacrificing one line as against sitting for 2 hours and writing a whole spot for Don Wilson, we immediately began to take Balzer and Perrin aside, saying, that's great, it should be, and Jack was adamant. He says, no, it goes this way, and we had to write a whole new spot for Don Wilson. And in retrospect, Jack was right, because the other was just another fat joke. Although we argued, Jack said it's just another fat joke, and we said, well, this is another cheap joke. He says, yes, but it is so clever. He says that we won't get another clever one like that. So he did take part in the shows, in the writing of the shows, to that extent. He always said that he couldn't write, but he was the best editor in the business.
I want to talk more about Jack Benny, and I want to talk about some of the things that developed while you were writing for him on radio for so many years after we take a short break. We're talking with Milt Josephburg, author of The Jack Benny Show, published by Arlington House. It was a good book when it came out a couple of years ago, and it's a terrific book yet. Our guest is Milt Josephburg, the author of The Jack Benny Show, published by Arlington House, a man who spent a good many years in radio and in television, one of the top comedy writers of all time, written for Bob Hope and for Jack Benny and Lucille Ball, Milton Berle, Danny Thomas, Phil Harris and Alice Faye, and so many, many others.
You're forgetting All in the Family?
I'm talking about the comedians from radio. All in the Family, of course.
Laverne and Shirley and Mark and Mindy. You left
business.
Out one or two. I'm glad you did.
Okay. I'll dub those in.
No, you don't know.
Milt, when you were working with Jack Benny, the writers would there were basically four writers on the show. And you all four of you just about joined Jack at about the same time.
We all joined.
1943, wasn't it?
1943. We joined in 1943. Sam Perrin, George Balzer, John Tackerberry, and I joined. And I probably was the least the worst of them because I only lasted 12 years. No, I Tackenberry and I left after 12 years. I went on to NBC and television and a couple of other things, mm-hmm. and Lucy. Mm-hmm. I created Lucy. I was with Lucy only 8 years. I created, incidentally, to most people who are not familiar with the business, anything that lasts over 3 years in television is a long career.
I would say so.
And any job that lasts over 3 years, someone once said that writing on a TV show is like going to junior high school. It's for 3 years, but it's usually a lot of fun.
Well, in the years that you were with Jack, you were responsible with the other writers for creating some of the elements of his character.
Oh, yes.
That lasted for years, and some gags. Now, you talk about certain gags that Bob Hope had or did and so forth, but I believe you were really involved very deeply with the gag where the crook is holding up Jack Benny and says, "Your money or your life."
Yes. Do you have a tape of that?
Yes.
Uh-huh. You do? All right, because somewhere I could get you a tape of it. It was in March of 1948. We were doing a thing where Jack borrowed Ronald Coleman's Oscar and to show it to Rochester. And the idea of this, we had a running thing for like 6 weeks where Jack would be robbed of the Oscar, and then to give Ronald Coleman his Oscar, he would borrow Bing Crosby's Oscar. Then he would be short an Oscar and would borrow Paul Lucas, who won an Oscar for, I don't remember.
Watch on the Rhine.
One of those pictures. But he would always be one Oscar behind, and this way we would always have the guest star, a full guest star, and then the following week when Jack returned the Oscar, he would have that person on for a couple of seconds, vignette, cameo appearance. I don't remember what happened with that, and nobody remembers what happened. But John Tackenberry and I had to write the thing where he came home and was robbed of the Oscar. And incidentally, this joke became, in Jack's obituary in Time magazine, they ran "Your Money or Your Life," long pause, "Burglar, Your Money or Your Life," "Jack Benny, I'm Thinking It Over." Jean Kerr wrote an article. She's the authoress, playwright, I think for the Saturday Evening Post, in which she said that only three great jokes can she remember from radio, and this was one of them. And it has been called the most famous joke in the history of broadcast, and it came about accidentally. Because Tackenberry and I had to write this, and now we had the thing with the burglar, the crook, who was played by a man named Eddie Marr, and he was supposed to hold Jack up. And now we're writing, and writers are very different people. I would be a pacer at times. John Tackenberry used to relax and half doze off on the couch, you know what I mean, until we had something and he'd snap too. And I said, we can't just say, okay, stick him up. I said, we got to get something real exciting. And suddenly I said, hey, I've got a line that I know is going to be funny. And it's the most obvious line. It's the cliche line. It's the classic line of all time. We just have the crook say, your money or your life, and have Jack stare at the audience, and we know there's going to be a laugh. And he says, yeah. I said, but we cannot give it. It must have the greatest answer in the world. And Tackenberry is relaxing. He says, yeah, yeah. And now on pace, I'm throwing a lot of lines, and I keep saying, your money or your life, and I'll throw the punchline, your money or your life. And I had one of them that wasn't bad, your money or your life, and Jack says, you mean I have a choice? Which, but I said, it's got to be better than that. And now I begin to get mad at Tackenberry, who I think is half asleep. And I said, come on, Tack, your money or your life, your money or your life. Come on, well, there must be something in that, your money or your life. And very angrily he says, I'm thinking it over. And I fell down, and he jumped up, and we said, that's it. And that is how the joke came into being. Mm-hmm. It was accidental.
Were there many occasions like that, that you just stumbled on the thing?
Oh, yes. Incidentally, let me say something about that joke. That joke had a 15-year build-up to it. That joke, from the first day Jack started on radio, when I was a kid in high school, I believe, they were building up this character, this cheap character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to build a joke properly. But then the writers who went before, and Jack always had great writers, he had a man named Harry Kahn at first, and he had Bill Morrow and Ed Boulogne, and they were great. But they kept harping on this character, and we were with him for 5 years before the joke came up. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, the joke really had the greatest buildup. One other incident I remember, it was an incident where we were trying to get a joke, and we used to do a running thing that when they went to New York, which was quite frequently in the days of radio, or Chicago, but in New York, Jack stayed at a place called the Acme Plaza Hotel. Now, we built this up as the crumb joint of all times, lower than Skid Row. One joke that we had where Jack said, they said, why do you stay at that hotel? And he says, well, it is so convenient. What other hotel has the 14th Street subway station as its lobby? Now, in New York, this means a lot because that's one of the busiest, dirtiest stations in the world. But this time, we had everybody jumping on Jack for staying at the hotel, and Mary finally got mad at him and said, why do you stay at that hotel? And we needed a punchline. Now, what happened with me is I said, I think I've got something. I started to tell a joke, and as I told it, the words came out differently. Not what I had planned, a completely different thought, which when I started, I had no intention of doing or no knowledge of, and I don't know how the heck I thought of it. And it was where Mary said, Jack, why do you stay at that hotel, that cheap, crummy hotel? And the joke that I came up with was, all right, Mary, I'll tell you why. Because when I was in vaudeville and I was laying off and I didn't have what to eat, he says, the manager of that hotel never dunned me for the rent that was due. And if he knew that I was hungry, he would, in the morning, put out a tray by my door with orange juice, coffee, and a donut. So that's why I stay at that hotel. And now Mary very contritely says, Jack, I didn't know that, but I'll tell you, if he was so nice, I'm going to stay at that hotel too. And Jack says, okay, but Mary, if you're running to the manager, don't let him know I'm working now. Now, I've had several examples. I had a time where I woke up out of a deep sleep and wrote a joke down that was a big joke. Mm-hmm. I don't remember it now. I also had one thing happen where my wife nearly divorced me because at a moment of great intimacy, I began laughing because I thought of a joke. These are things that happen. I must also say that one thing that I felt ashamed of, and I talked to a psychiatrist. I never went to a psychiatrist. I'm one of the few writers who hasn't gone, but I met a psychiatrist, and it bothered me, and I said, look, why was I able to write a very funny routine and think of funny things when I was flying in a plane to my father's funeral? And I adored my father. Mm-hmm. He said, if you were a lawyer, he said, you wouldn't worry over the fact that you thought of a case and was able to do it there. But I mean, but sometimes jokes come to you at odd times, at funerals and things like that.
Well, it is an escapism too, I think, sometimes.
I don't know.
And if it's your business.
I don't know. It's one of those things.
In your book, you refer to one of the most expensive radio gags of all time.
Yes.
What was it?
Well, what it was, also in my book, I mentioned, because I was showed somebody the spot, the place on the stage that I had the most expensive television joke, and it was also with Jack Benny, but that was Jack as a guest on Lucy's show. But in radio, We had a thing where Jack and Mary were supposedly taking a walk and it began to rain. So Mary says, oh, look, here's an auction. There's an auction. Let's go and we'll sit down and we'll talk and maybe we'll have something worthwhile. So they sit in, and now the auctioneer says, now we come to a very beautiful piece for collectors. It is an elephant. It is an umbrella stand made out of the leg of an elephant shot by the Maharaja of Cooch Behar. So Jack says, ooh, big deal. Somebody says, I'll start the bidding with $50. Jack says, I wouldn't give 10 cents for a thing like that. She says, Jack, keep quiet. And somebody says, 60. See, and Jack says, they're all idiots. She says, Jack, will you stop? Now, we had the late B. Benaderet, who was the mother on Petticoat Junction, I believe. Mm-hmm. She was one of the people bidding. We had Mel Blanc in there bidding. We had a fellow named Ed Kearns. I think we may have had Sheldon Leonard. But we had six expensive radio actors who Jack used frequently. Mm-hmm. And they were bidding, and the auctioneer was going. And we typed it up. They read from scripts. The people who are bidding on one side and Jack and Mary on the other. Now, the people kept bidding 60, 70, 75, 80, and Jack kept saying, idiots, and she says, Jack, will you stop talking about that? Let's talk about next week's show. Now, as they're talking about next week's show, this bidding keeps going up. Mm-hmm. And Jack says, for next week's show, and these are going on simultaneously, for next week's show, we've got a funny script where we're going to have Bob Hope as a guest. She says, that's wonderful. And she says, by the way, have you set Bob Hope? And the bidding is now 110, 120, you know. And he says, no. He says, she says, you know, he's very expensive. He says, Mary, I don't mind that. I mean, if I have to pay him, I'll pay him $500, $600. She says, Jack, for a guest appearance, Bob Hope gets $10,000. And Jack screams, $10,000 sold to the blue-eyed gentleman for $10,000. That was the joke. And now what happened with that was the only one, I believe, that would have the courage to do that would be Jack Benny, because this took almost 2.5 to 3 minutes. And with the average radio comic in those days, if you didn't hear a laugh in 20 seconds, every mm-hmm. 20 seconds, mm-hmm. you'd get frightened. But Jack did that, and the scream was worth it.
He was a very confident man, wasn't he?
Yes. As a matter of fact, while we're on that, another show that we did, we started a radio season with a most unique show. And only a Jack Benny would do a thing like this. Because when you came back after being off for the summer, all of the comedians told their writers, get me on as quick as possible, get me as funny as possible, get me those jokes as quickly as possible. Now, Bob Hope had it solved because he started with his monologue, mm-hmm. and right away, in 3 to 4 minutes, he did 15 to 20 big, big jokes. But all the other comedians wanted to start off their new season so the audience would know they're back and know they're funny. But we had an idea once where we started the show where Don Wilson said, ladies and gentlemen, and it's not well known, but the Beverly Hills Chamber of Commerce runs a free sightseeing tour bus through Beverly Hills, and now we take you aboard that bus. Now we had several high-priced performers on that bus, and the bus driver would do jokes like, ladies and gentlemen, we are now passing the home of so-and-so, and these will all sound dated now, and maybe some of the audience won't get them, but that beautiful house to the left of us with the swimming pool in the front belongs to W.C. Fields. And the lady on the bus says, what are those green marbles at the bottom of the swimming pool? And the driver said, those are olives. Now, for the benefit of those who don't remember, he did the Dean Martin jokes, the drinking jokes of the day. Yes. Was W.C. Fields. Then he said, we are now passing the home Phil and Alice Faye, and we would fade into that home, and we had like 3 minutes of Phil and Alice Faye talking about Phil going back on the show and starting the new season. Mm-hmm. Then back on the bus, and the driver said, we are now passing the home behind that stand of palm trees is the home of Orson Welles. Orson designed the house, landscape design, painted, did this and everything to the house. The trees were planted by God. Next, we come to the home of Don Wilson. We fade in, and Don Wilson did the commercial with his wife. Then the sound of the bus came up again, and the bus driver would have another joke and says, we are now passing the home of Dennis Day. And we'd fade in, we did a routine with Dennis and his mother, and Dennis sang his song. We kept doing this, and not one word about Jack Benny. Until finally, we had the bus driver say, and now, on the corner, we are passing the house of Jack Benny, and you hear Jack's voice for the first time say, stop the bus, I get off here. And we were 25 minutes into mm-hmm. the show. He got off the bus, did a routine with Rochester about how Rochester missed him during the summer mm-hmm. vacation and everything. And that was the end of the show. Now, we got much acclaim that only Jack Benny would have the chutzpah, which I don't have to define for you, was a Yiddish mm-hmm. word meaning nerve. The chutzpah to do a show where on his opening show he would not appear for that much time. And the following week, one reviewer mentioned that Jack Benny did not appear on his opening show until the final 4 minutes, but then he showed who was the star of the show. Now, we had Don Wilson read that excerpt from the review. He says, and now we present our 4-minute star, Jack Benny. And we started off the show that way. But Jack would do many unusual things. We brought many things were handed to us. The Maxwell was handed to us. But we brought the train call, train leaving on track 5 for Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga. We brought the famous Jack Benny vault. Mm-hmm. We brought in the part that Sheldon Leonard, the tout, where if Jack went to buy an apple, Sheldon Leonard would tout him off onto a banana. And whatever it was, but he was a racetrack tout that mm-hmm. was never at the racetrack, although we once did a show where he was at the racetrack. But we had... incidentally, at the racetrack, he touted Jack off to sitting into a different box than the one he was sitting at. Never touted on a horse. But we brought many of these things. But as I said, we had a wonderful path laid out for us by the previous writers.
Well, you had a lot of leeway, obviously, from Jack, who just was there and whose character was being created.
Oh, yes.
And
incidentally,
just went through all of that.
His character was so well established that other comedians began doing weekly jokes about his violin playing. Oh, we brought the French violin teacher mm-hmm. who was played by Mel Blanc. But other comedians used to do jokes about him wearing a toupee, which incidentally he didn't, and playing the piano lousy and being very cheap. And Jack once came in with an edict. He didn't want to do any more cheap jokes or lousy violin playing jokes or wearing toupee jokes. And we said, Jack, that's not going to stop the other comedians, and people will still think you're doing it. The only thing that we can do is we must do them a little more cleverly. And we did. And we had one thing where Jack came home once, and he says, Rochester, were there any calls for me? He says, yes, sir, boss. He says, your barber and your dentist called. He says, what did they say? He says, you can pick them both up tomorrow. Now, we never said toupee, and Jack didn't wear false teeth, but we had that. We did a thing once where they were out riding in the car, and with the Maxwell with the top down, and Dennis Day was sitting in the back seat. He says, oh, a squirrel fell out of a tree and fell into my lap. And Jack says, put that back on my head. You know? Now, we would do the jokes, and we had to use great cleverness. Incidentally, on this thing, I joined the All in the Family show. It had been on for 4 or 5 years. And by then, all the racial jokes had been done. And whenever we did a racial joke or anything, we had two rules. It must be the cleverest thing that could be done. And he must be slapped down by whoever he did the joke to.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a change in there. Because you get tired of the same thing, and yet if you lose that, you can lose the character.
Mm-hmm. It was a perfect way that you kept that rolling for Jack.
Oh, yes. Oh, one thing I must tell you. I once had an idea, and we thought this would run for 6 or 7 weeks. And the idea was that Jack was taking inventory of the stuff in the house, and a 5-gallon or tremendous can of pineapple juice or tomato juice would fall on Jack's head and knock him out. When Rochester brought him to, what would happen was that he was perfectly healthy, excepting for one thing. Instead of being a spendthrift, instead of being a miser, he was a spendthrift, and he was going to go on a spending spree. And we thought we would run this for several weeks. We had great difficulty in writing it. Jack had great difficulty in doing it because every joke that we did went against the character. And all we were able to do was the following week we did it and had him snap out of it and come right back to where he was, because that character was so strongly established.
Milt, did you... I know in your book you talk about the occasional gift that would be bestowed upon the writers for mentioning a commercial product on the show.
Yes.
Did that last a long time? And you had a lot of fun with it, didn't you?
Yes, we did. It lasted a while, and I'll tell you what stopped it was the big scandal on the quiz shows.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. And there were comedians who, incidentally, Jack never got anything excepting on one occasion. He mentioned that he was going to give someone a television set for a gift, and we said, we think we can get one free, and we did a joke that got one.
What was the joke? How'd you get it?
Oh, we did a show where Jack and Mary's actual daughter, Joan, they did a show where Jack dreamed that he was married to Mary, and they had a daughter named Joan. And Mary was his wife in the thing, and Joan had a boyfriend, and they were looking at the television set, and his picture was on the television set, and she said, that's a picture of my father in the Navy. And the boyfriend said, gosh, an Admiral. She says, no, that's the television set. And we got an Admiral television set. But we had one rule. The joke had to be funnier than any other joke that was in the show. Jack said, fellas, I don't mind you doing this. It was a little graft or something. And I don't mind you doing this, but I want to make sure that every joke that we did was that much funnier. Now, at that time, there was a thing called Hattacall on the market. Hattacall was owned or promoted by Colonel Parker, who was Elvis Presley's, later became Elvis Presley's manager. And Hattacall made you feel good, and I never took it, but I understand it should make you feel good because it was loaded with alcohol. But it was a cure-all for everything, the advertiser for everything. And we had two jokes that I remember, and that was a plug. And when you did a plug, they would send you a case of whiskey or something like that. And we did a thing where Dennis Day came in late to a show once, and Jack said, how come you were late? He says, well, yesterday my uncle was run over by a truck and he was crushed, and it was a terrible thing. And Jack said, wait a minute, Dennis, I saw your uncle this morning. He looked perfectly healthy. Dennis says, oh, yeah. He says, the truck was loaded with Hattacall, which was a big laugh. And the other thing was where Jack and Phil Harris got into a discussion about playing golf, and Phil challenged Jack to a game of golf for $1 a hole, and Jack backed out. And Dennis says, Phil, I'll play you for $100 a hole. Well, that line was funny because Dennis was supposedly getting $35 a week. And Phil said, it's a match. And Jack says to Dennis, "Dennis, I didn't know you played golf." He says, "I don't." He says, "Have you been taking lessons?" He says, "No." He says, "How do you expect to beat Phil Harris? He's one of the best amateur players in the world." Dennis says, "I've been taking Hattacall." So these jokes were funny. And one occasion, plugs were so well known that we did a thing where Jack was going to bed one night, and Rochester says, "Boss, you know, it's kind of cold." Excuse me. Last thing I said was Rochester was cold. Said, "Boss, the house is cold.
Mm-hmm.
Should I turn on the furnace?" And Jack says, "No, just plug in my General Electric blanket." And Rochester says, "Boss, you don't have a General Electric blanket." He says, "I have now." Then later in the show, we had that wonderful character, Frank Nelson, ring the doorbell. And Jack said to him, "What is it?" He says, "I'm from General Electric. Where should I plug it in?" Now, General Electric was not a plug. But what General Electric did, they were so thrilled with this thing that they sent General Electric blankets to everybody connected with the show, including the writers. But that was not a plug there. But the public was aware of it. I remember Bob Hope did a joke where he kidded plugs. And he said, "You know," he says, "if you mention a product, a commercial product on the air," he says, "they usually send you samples." He said, "And 3 weeks ago, I mentioned Gillette razors, and they sent me a bunch of Gillette razors. And then 2 weeks ago, I mentioned Martha Washington candy, and they sent me pounds of candy. And last week, I decided to really press my luck, and I mentioned Cadillac on the air. And sure enough, on the way home, I got hit by one." But the plugs were a part of the business.
You've been a part of the business for many years.
Many years.
You've been a successful working comedy writer for all of these years. If you had a chance to write a radio show for Jack Benny again, would you do it now?
I would jump immediately. I would give anything to do that. But I guess it's, you know, going back, everything seemed better in those days. But I would say that my associations were very, very happy. They had to be, or you don't stay that long. There were several shows that I was with I do not mention because I was not happy on them. I served brief terms with them. But all of those that you mentioned, Danny Thomas and Milton Berle, of course, Lucy and Jack and Bob, and I will tell you a funny story about Bob in a second, but all in the family, I stayed many years with them. Funny thing, about a year ago, I was leaving a studio just at dusk, and I must point out that due to a childhood accident, I don't see very well on my right side. And as I was leaving the studio, coming in the studio, were four gentlemen dressed in ties. We call them people who wear suits. They are usually executives, and we don't hobnob with them, or they won't hobnob with us. But anyway, Anyway, I'm leaving the studio, and I pass these four people, and they're passing me on my right, and one of them says, "Hi, Milt," and I say hi, and I keep walking, and this man reaches out and grabs me, turns me around, I come face to face with Bob Hope, and he says, "That's all I get." And I said, "God, Bob, I'm sorry, but you know I don't see so good, and it's dark. I didn't recognize you." And he smiled at me. He says, "You got it wrong, kid. You're supposed to recognize me. I'm not supposed to recognize you." Which I thought was very funny. And driving home, I began to laugh at the thing.
I know you have many memories, and we're pleased that you took some time with us today to share them with us. And so many more memories of Jack Benny are in your book, The Jack Benny Show. And it's published by Arlington House. And if there is anybody listening who does not have a copy of it yet, I recommend it. I've read it many times. I've enjoyed it. And I know that they'll enjoy the man, Jack Benny, and they'll enjoy your humor and your memories as well.
And it's 4 years that it's been published. I don't need the money, But read the book. Go to the library and ask for it. They usually have it.
Mm-hmm.
You won't find it in the stores, but many libraries have it, and it's worth reading, particularly to anyone who's over 50.
To anyone of any age, because you can enjoy Jack Benny's humor and your telling of his
I get a lot of fan mail from kids, high school, college students who have read the book, and they were very interested in it. You know, that they never heard Jack. Some of them never heard of Fred Allen, either.
Well, it's their loss, then, too,
yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Yeah, it's been our gain to be with you today. Thanks very much, Milt Joseph.
Thank you very, very much.